FM Madison.
The time is 6 p.m. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, March the 26th, 2025. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Amy Owen. In tonight's news, Madison leaders declare this coming Monday Trans Day of Visibility.
An incumbent alder who's running unopposed this spring describes the work ahead of him.
And in the second half, we'll dissect a conservative commentator's remarks at a UW-Madison event. Revisit some headlines from 62 years ago, and broadcast the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves.
In every possible detail. All these stories and more coming at you this evening, so stay tuned. But first we'll go live to London for some news from around the world from the BBC.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Sudan's military leader says the army has regained full control of Khartoum from its rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan made the announcement, surrounded by cheering soldiers. From Port Sudan, here's Barbara Platt-Usher.
General Fattah al-Burhan flew into that newly reclaimed airport, and he made this announcement from the historic Republican Palace. He said Khartoum is free, that palace being a potent symbol of sovereignty and political power. So this is a very big day for the army. It gives them a strategic advantage in the war, but the fighting is now expected to shift to the west, to Darfur, where the RSF controls very large parts, most of that region. And just this week, the army was accused of bombing a marketplace that killed dozens, possibly hundreds of civilians.
President Trump has announced a 25% tariff on all cars imported into the United States from the 2nd of April. He claimed the measure would spur growth in the U.S. car industry and create jobs and investment. He said overseas manufacturers were looking to build car plants in high numbers in the U.S.
Before I was elected, we were losing all of our plants. They were being built in Mexico and Canada and other places. Now those plants largely have stopped and they're moving them to our country.
President Trump also said further tariffs will follow on the lumber and pharmaceutical sectors. The Trump administration has already imposed a 25% duty on steel and aluminium imports. Democrats in Congress have been grilling top security officials on how planned airstrikes in Yemen came to be discussed in a group chat that included a prominent journalist. The messages, with precise times for when U.S. warplanes and missiles would be launched, have now been published by The Atlantic magazine. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has said inviting a journalist into the chat was a big mistake.
Nothing against journalists, but you ain't supposed to be on that thing. Look, I think the White House is looking at this entire thing. How did that journalist get on there? Why was this the appropriate? And I think there'll be reforms and changes made, so this was not going to happen again. It can't.
Turkey's main opposition leader says protests will continue nationwide until Istanbul's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, is released. Özgür Özel said a major demonstration was planned in Istanbul on Saturday to kick off the party's campaign to make Mr. İmamoğlu the next president in 3 years' time. Mr. İmamoğlu, seen as President Erdogan's main political rival, was arrested a week ago on corruption and terror charges. The presidents of Ukraine and France, Volodymyr Zelensky and Emmanuel Macron, have said Russia cannot dictate the terms of a lasting peace with Ukraine and must accept a 30-day limited ceasefire without conditions. Speaking in Paris, Mr. Zelensky accused Russia of lying about the outcome of talks in Saudi Arabia, where the US brokered a Black Sea ceasefire. He said he expected Washington to ensure an unconditional deal after Moscow insisted on Tuesday it would go ahead once certain sanctions had been lifted. BBC News. The Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk has said his government is preparing to temporarily suspend the right of asylum for migrants. Mr. Tusk said the government would adopt the measure without delay. Poland is facing a wave of arrivals of migrants across its eastern border, which Warsaw thinks is a hybrid war tactic orchestrated by the governments in Belarus and Russia. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, is to go on trial for allegedly plotting a military coup. The Supreme Court has ruled there's enough evidence for the case against Mr. Bolsonaro and seven of his allies to go ahead. He denies trying to block the inauguration of his successor, President Lula, and says he's the victim of political persecution.
I hope to put an end to this today. It seems like there's something personal against me, and the accusations are very serious. They are baseless.
Mr. Bolsonaro never publicly acknowledged losing the election in 2022. Thousands of his supporters stormed government buildings after Lula took office. The trial is expected later this year. The Bolivian government has declared a national state of emergency due to months of severe flooding, which have killed at least 50 people and affected thousands of families. The move will free up more resources for the worst hit areas. Senior police in Balochistan say at least six people were killed on Wednesday in a spate of coordinated attacks in Pakistan's restless southwestern province. According to the French news agency, police accused gunmen of targeting bus passengers on the basis of their ethnicity. Chinese doctors have for the first time transplanted a pig liver into a brain-dead human recipient. The organ from a genetically modified miniature pig was inserted into the adult with his family's permission. The doctors say it functioned well and produced bile. The experiment was terminated after 10 days. While there have been several successful pig-to-human kidney and heart transplants, the liver's role is more complex.
Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Amy Owen bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
Both political parties are investing heavily in the race for state superintendent of public instruction, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The race was narrowed down to two candidates in the February primary, incumbent Superintendent Jill Underley and challenger Brittany Kinzer. Since then, both candidates have received more than $1 million in donations, according to state filings released this week. The majority of that funding comes from political parties, which can give and receive unlimited donations. The Democratic Party of Wisconsin is backing incumbent Superintendent Jill Underley, giving $850,000 of the $1.1 million she's raised for her campaign since February. Meanwhile, challenger Brittany Kinzer has received almost $1.7 million from the state's Republican Party. The self-described school choice candidate has raised about $2.2 million total since February. This kind of party investment is unusual in a nonpartisan race. Including in-kind donations, the state's Democratic Party contributed $440,000 to Underley after the primary in 2021. Campaign donations in the race for Wisconsin's top education official still pales in comparison to the record-breaking race for state Supreme Court. Thanks to out-of-state megadonors, that race is expected to surpass $100 million by Election Day, reports the Wisconsin Examiner.
Construction projects on the Ice Age Trail are in limbo due to federal spending changes under Donald Trump. Less than half of the nearly 1,200-mile path is fully connected, and connectivity is a top priority for the Ice Age Trail Alliance, a partnering nonprofit. Largely thanks to volunteers, the Alliance has connected 25 additional miles of the trail over the past 2 years. Their efforts have brought more than $3 million to local economies along the trail, the Alliance estimates. Eight more projects were on their docket, but half of them are now delayed while the Alliance awaits nearly $600,000 in promised federal spending. Meanwhile, the trail's Park Service office has had its staff cut from 7 to 4.
Passengers traveling by rail between Chicago and Milwaukee this afternoon had their plans disrupted. Routes along four different Amtrak lines were canceled after safety inspectors discovered corrosion in several rail cars, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Four lines are affected. That's the Downeaster, Hiawatha, Borealis, and Amtrak Cascades. Some will continue to operate with fewer cars. Others will offer a bus substitute.
The State Building Commission will not be recommending more than $4 billion in capital projects proposed by the governor. That comes after a split vote on the commission earlier this week. The 8-member body includes the governor, along with 4 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and a citizen appointed by the governor. Republican lawmakers say that although Evers' proposals included, quote, worthy projects, it wasn't realistic. The proposal included projects for the UW system, state prisons and health facilities, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Natural Resources. According to Evers, investment in these projects would be critical to reforming the correction system and addressing Wisconsin's aging infrastructure. The legislature's Budget Writing Committee, that's the Joint Finance Committee, will begin work on their version of the state budget next week.
A little-known state bill drew the most lobbying last session, and it's back before state lawmakers for the third time. The so-called Right to First Refusal Bill would give utilities already doing business in Wisconsin first dibs on building new transmission lines. Supporters say that the bill would keep the utility business local, provide jobs for Wisconsin workers, and ensure transmission projects are completed faster. But opponents say it would limit competition and raise energy prices for consumers. Last session, lobbyists spent more than $57 million and dedicated nearly 5,800 hours trying to influence the state capitol on a similar measure. To compare, bills in the last session that received at least 1 hour of lobbying time each averaged less than 78 hours total. No lobbying hours have been reported yet for the current session, reports the Wisconsin State Journal.
If you get Social Security benefits, you may have to head down to your local office to prove your identity instead of doing so online. The Social Security Administration says the measures will beef up identity protection. The new rules kick in on Monday. The changes come as many Social Security offices are closing and facing an all-time high number of beneficiaries, along with an all-time low in staffing. Last night, the Madison Common Council passed a resolution opposing Social Security office closures and other cuts to Social Security, along with Medicare and Medicaid. Here's Jessica LaPointe, a claims specialist working in the Madison Social Security field office on O'Dana Road. She spoke about the situation on the ground.
So the situation at Social Security right here serving members of the Madison community is pretty dire. We've had about a 50% staff reduction in just the last 3 years alone. We typically have about 28 employees who are frontline workers, trained up workers serving the Madison area. We're now reduced to 14. And the Madison Social Security office, as many of you may know if you've tried to call or visit, is really struggling to keep up with public demand based on the sort of stripped to the bone staffing that we have.
Testimony given last night during the Common Council meeting. For the sake of transparency, LaPointe is also a WORT board member.
Meanwhile, last year's State Street Pedestrian Mall project was a success. That's according to a report on the experiment also taken up at last night's Common Council meeting. Data collected by Madison's Central Business District showed that the experiment area saw more activity overall, while surveys found the majority of visitors to State Street found it safer and more vibrant during pedestrian mall hours. Business response was mixed, with less than half of the respondents voicing approval. The street closure hours were more popular, however, with only 37% of businesses saying they should have been shorter. Future iterations of the pedestrian mall project could include retractable barriers to control non-emergency vehicular traffic, mid-block raised pedestrian crossings, and lighting upgrades. Also under consideration would be limiting traffic on the 400 to 600 blocks to one way and allowing loading on one side of the street only. But there's no dedicated budget or staff to run the experiment this year.
And those were the evening's headlines. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories. Madison Alders unanimously approved a resolution last night recognizing next Monday as Trans Day of Visibility. Our producer Faye Parks and reporter Dane Bulow have the story.
Last night was Alder Dina Nina Martinez Rutherford's last city council meeting. The first transgender Alder isn't running again for local office next Tuesday. But last night, amidst a wave of national attacks against the transgender community, Alder Martinez Rutherford approached tears in bringing the resolution to her colleagues. She commemorated leaders like Josie Carter, a black trans woman who led the charge in Black Knight Brawl of 1961, Milwaukee's own Stonewall Riot. Thanks to forerunners like Carter, Alder Martinez Rutherford says trans people are more visible than ever, but that visibility brings new challenges.
10 years ago, we weren't in spaces like this. We weren't on television. And now that visibility is costing us, but we will rise and fight, and we will be here whether you want us to be here or not. And everybody deserves to feel esteemed and valued.
Madison resident Mercury Stardust also spoke. Online, she's a popular TikToker who provides home maintenance advice to more than 1 million followers. She's known as Trans Handy Ma'am. She says that in this moment, being seen as transgender is a double-edged sword.
For a lot of trans people, especially black trans women, it is extremely dangerous to be visible in the world in which we live in. Disproportionately, black trans women are killed in our community more than any other demographic. So when we talk about trans day of visibility, what we're really talking about is trying to stand up against that, trying to take up space in spite of that danger, in spite of that fear.
Speakers emphasized yesterday that trans people are also a favored political target for the far right. Last year alone, the state legislature considered 14 bills targeting transgender people. None passed. Alder Martinez Rutherford credits Governor Tony Evers for using his veto power, but says,
"The defeat of these bills is just one example of the resistance this discrimination has been met with, showing the strength and resilience of the trans community and our allies."
But state Republicans are taking up similar measures again in this new session. The state assembly passed 4 bills just last week targeting transgender Wisconsinites, 3 of them along party lines. The first would require school boards to prohibit teachers from identifying a student by a name or pronoun that does not align with their assigned gender at birth. The second would prohibit gender-affirming medical procedures for anyone under 18. The third would require that all sports teams in public universities and technical schools be divided by sex. The fourth bill sets the same requirements for sports teams in K-12, public and private schools. One Democrat, Russell Goodwin of Milwaukee, joined all Republicans in voting for the measure. The bills head next to the Republican-held state Senate. Along with Alder Martinez Rutherford and Mercury Stardust, local drag performer Cass Downing also spoke last night, sharing a message of encouragement for the next generation.
You are valid. Everything you feel as a transgender youth is real. These are things that you can find help to figure out within yourself, and it will come from you. It cannot come from anybody else. And you are lovable, you are worthy of respect, and you can grow up into a transgender adult and be successful.
For WORT News, I'm Dane Bulow. Fate Parks contributed in reporting to this story.
It's now 6:18 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. Alder Derek Field has served on the City Council since 2023. He's one of a handful of incumbent alders who are running unopposed this spring. His name is the only one that'll appear on the ballot for voters in Far East Side District 3. His goals for his second term on the council include protecting the environment, accommodating Madison's growing population, and continuing violence prevention efforts throughout the city. Sitting down with WORT reporter Sutton Johnson, Alder Field described the work ahead.
Hello, my name is Derek Field. I've lived in Madison since 2012, so going on 13 years now. And by day, I am a data and policy analyst. I've worked for a couple of state agencies and most recently UW-Madison.
Why are you running again for Common Council?
There's some unfinished work that I want to keep working on and an opportunity coming up over the next term. I am running to make sure that the city does thoughtful land use planning when mapping out the future uses of parcels in my district and in our neighborhoods, and planning on the necessary infrastructure and service improvements necessary to support the city's growth. I'm also running to support community factors that prevent gun violence by bringing resources into the neighborhoods, activating outdoor spaces. And that has been a challenge in some parts of my district where we have seen a pattern of gun violence. So it's an issue that definitely needs all of our attention. Finally, I think I provide good service. I do a lot of constituent relations work. I proactively meet with and share issues with neighborhood associations in the district to keep up with what's going on in city processes, in the budget, to make sure that everybody's voices are heard and that I'm bringing concerns from Eastsiders to the city.
What is one specific achievement in your time as alder that drove you forward in your latest term on the council?
I really appreciate a lot of elements that went into the Northeast Area Plan. So that plan includes two neighborhoods in my district, as well as a lot of other area on the northeast side of the city. And it includes some areas that are challenged by some discontinuous development patterns as former other municipalities have merged with Madison and former industrial sites. So there are a couple of awkward park shapes and land uses that I think we can use better in the future. And I strongly believe that the Northeast Area Plan accomplishes that while planning for the community's growth in a thoughtful way. And in particular, as part of that planning process, there was a controversy around a proposed street extension along the south end of and over the corner of Sycamore Park in my district, which is just a jewel of the east side, I will say. During the planning process, we heard from a lot of neighbors who were concerned about the impacts on the park and their uses of the park, others' uses of the park. And the recently adopted Sycamore Park Master Plan had mapped a bike course in the corner of the park that was set to be lost to the road. And so as part of the adoption process, when the final draft of the Northeast Area Plan moved through the approval process, I authored the motion to remove the street extension. And many of my constituents participated in the city decision-making process to come and speak on this issue and raise their concerns. So that involved a lot of sharing information about how to do so, arguments that would be compelling. And we did eventually succeed in removing the street extension from Sycamore Park in the Northeast Area Plan. I want to bring that mindset to thinking about residents' voices and the needs to accommodate growth and service improvements in the Southeast Area Plan, too, which will cover much of my district.
Now, it sounds like you have a lot planned for this park plan. Is that what you spent the most time on in your latest term on the council?
I spent a lot of time on the Northeast Area Plan, I will say, because resident engagement was difficult in these couple of neighborhoods in my district that overlap with that plan. But I would say the most time that I've spent on any issue was with the Harmony Apartments. That is a struggling property in my district that was added to a part of the city that is not built out completely yet. And so being an incomplete neighborhood, there are very few resources and services available in this corner of the city near a quarry and a highway. The Harmony Apartments has had some challenges over the last couple of years that I believe are ultimately stemmed from the lack of resources and amenities offered there, either by neighboring land uses or by that area's or that property's management, who, upon approval, talked about coming in and adding a lot of these amenities to support their residents, and we just haven't seen that come to fruition. So in 2023, there was a very tragic pattern of gun violence that resulted in the loss of two young lives and injuries to others. Following those incidents, the city has had a very significant presence on a regular basis in the form of our violence prevention personnel, the neighborhood resource officer through East District Police, and a variety of other stakeholders and partners who have stepped up and worked with the city to build relationships with the residents of the Harmony, provide programming for their kids, and host listening sessions. Most recently, the building condition of the property has been the utmost concern, as its owners and management have struggled to keep up with some of the maintenance needs that end up compounding on each other, such as water damage, you know, a problem that leads to other problems. And so this is most definitely the issue that I've spent the most time on, either with resident meetings or catching up with city staff on the scope and nature of services and needs out there, discussing with neighbors and the rest of the neighborhood surrounding the Harmony who have concerns and have also stepped up to participate in programming and bring resources to the property. And ultimately, I did sponsor a ordinance change to the chronic public nuisance premises ordinance that the city has for handling violent offenses as more severe than nonviolent offenses when we're considering eligibility for nuisance premises orders. So that issue has been something I've spent a lot of time on in a variety of ways in my first term.
Housing impacts everyone, from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job paying about $28 per hour, or about $58,000 a year. This issue might be the city's most sprawling and complicated problem. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis? You've spoken about this issue before, saying we should roll back restrictions on zoning. Could you explain what that means for the average citizen of Madison and how it could help us?
It certainly is a complicated issue, and I agree, one of the most important ones. Zoning is a way to restrict uses on property and parcels in the city, and so that's the size of buildings and the uses of buildings and the building forms. Existing zoning rules, I think, were written in large part to keep neighborhoods the same and to defend them from change. And I think that the need for change in Madison is evident in the imbalance between housing supply and housing demand, where tenants or buyers are competing for too few units, ultimately, which drives up the prices and hands a lot of power to the landlords. I think that zoning reform can be incremental and allow gentle and gradual increases in density, especially along arterial roads where we have transit service, but in neighborhood settings where it's appropriate too, where there's access to the economy, where within walking distance there are more services. I feel that these are appropriate areas where the city can add to its housing stock. And in many cases, zoning laws make it very hard or very expensive to do that right now. So I think that it's appropriate for us to consider gentle increases in density by rolling some of those back, again, where appropriate.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit?
I think we need to keep in mind some of those 5% cut scenarios that agencies advanced for our consideration in the event that the referendum didn't pass, because some of those are lower impact and I think can be adopted without residents feeling too much of a cut to their city services. But that is a small portion. The structural problem that we're looking at is a pretty significant one. And my highest priority for working on that is getting fully refunded for the municipal services that we provide to state property. That's a reimbursement program funded through the state biennial budget, but it's only funded to the tune of 37 cents on the dollar compared to what it actually costs to provide services to state property. Now, Madison is the seat of state government, and so any decisions, for example, to underfund this line in the state budget will disproportionately affect Madison and Madison taxpayers because we have to provide those services under the law to state property here. So I believe the memo to the Joint Finance Committee in this last session noted that it was a 30% funding that they allocated to municipal governments to offset the cost of these services, which shorts us by many millions of dollars. And I think that for fairness and for the sake of other municipalities that also have state property, I think we can make headway on this issue by building a coalition. So that's certainly a priority of mine and something I want to be involved in.
I'd like to ask you what you think about the council itself. The council has a high turnover rate with elections every 2 years. And even then, some alders resign early, largely over time commitment. How much time would you say you spend being an alder each week?
That's a really important topic that the community will need to reckon with at some point as the city grows and as our districts continue to grow and get more complicated. It depends on the week for me, but I have a full-time day job and I need to defend my boundaries between this night gig and my full-time day job. So I end up doing alder work most evenings, if not every evening, and then every single weekend there is some cluster of hours that I'm spending preparing for the next week, catching up on constituent emails. It's probably, on average, a little over 20 hours a week, but that ebbs and flows with the schedule of council meetings and with issues that come up in my district or pieces of legislation that I'm studying, such as the city budget. So it requires a lot of very disciplined and proactive time management in order to pull that off, and having very understanding family members who can accommodate that kind of a schedule, which is not an easy thing to do and to ask. So I do think that at some point the structure of city government needs to change. Again, as our districts continue to grow and become more complicated, we're going to need more capacity from elected officials in order to keep up with that growth, either in the form of full-time alders or, I wouldn't prefer going this way, but more alders in smaller districts.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to say to our viewers at WORT?
just if you want to read more about me or some of the things that I think are important for Madison and have worked on, check out my website at voteforderekfield.com, and please feel free to reach out anytime.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. There's a lot more coming at you in the second half. We'll be dissecting a conservative commentator's remarks at a UW-Madison event. We'll travel back in time to 1963, and I'll hopefully be dissecting the upcoming storm for this coming weekend and tell you how much rain this Sunday will hold.
But now we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
For over 10 years, Mama Cares has been there for local musicians in their time of need, whether to help with medical expenses or other personal calamities. The Madison Area Music Association invites you to Mama Cares' 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon, featuring live performances by Sam Ness, Gin Chocolate and Bottle Rockets, and The Jimmies. Help your local musicians and enjoy some live music at the Mama Cares 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th, from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. You're listening to WORT Madison.
BBC News with David Harper. The military leader of Sudan says his forces have retaken the capital, Khartoum, from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan made the announcement in a televised address from the presidential palace, surrounded by cheering soldiers. President Trump says the United States will impose a 25% tariff on all foreign cars imported into the United States from next Wednesday. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the measure would be bad for transatlantic businesses and bad for consumers. Senior Trump officials have faced questions in Congress over how confidential details of imminent U.S. airstrikes on Yemen were discussed in an unsecured group chat that included a prominent political journalist. Mr. Trump again downplayed the incident, calling it a witch hunt. The party of South Sudan's first vice president say the former rebel leader has been arrested. Rekindled tensions between Riek Machar supporters and forces loyal to the president Salva Kiir are threatening to plunge the country back into civil war. The leader of the main opposition party in Turkey has said demonstrations will continue nationwide until Istanbul's mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu is released. The CHP is campaigning to make Mr. İmamoğlu the next president in elections due in 3 years' time. Police in Balochistan say at least six people were killed on Wednesday in a spate of coordinated attacks in Pakistan's restless southwestern province. They said the victims included a member of the security forces. The Lithuanian army has said it has no information to indicate that four American soldiers who went missing during military drills are dead. It said it had recovered the armored vehicle the men had been operating during a training exercise. Chinese doctors have for the first time transplanted a pig liver into a brain-dead human recipient. The organ from a genetically modified miniature pig functioned well and produced bile. There have previously been successful pig-to-human kidney and heart transplants. BBC News.
Now, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host this evening, Amy Owen. Thanks for joining us.
Up next is Cardinal Call, our weekly segment featuring news from the UW-Madison campus. Conservative commentator Heather McDonald was in Madison this month for an event at the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy. She used her platform to condemn diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts on college campuses across the country. Host Ted Hingstrom sat down with Daily Cardinal staff writer Jake Piper to learn more.
Welcome to Cardinal Call, your biweekly dose of news from UW-Madison's own Daily Cardinal student newspaper. We are your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom.
Conservative political voice Heather McDonald condemned DEI efforts on college campuses at a Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy event Thursday. Today, we're joined by Daily Cardinal staff writer Jake Piper to discuss McDonald's remarks to the center while we talk about his recent story, Heather McDonald Blasts DEI, Says It Works to Cover Up the Racial Skill Gap, during UW-Madison visit.
Welcome, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us some background on who Heather MacDonald is?
Yeah, so Heather MacDonald is a conservative think tank author and political commentator who graduated from Yale in the 70s, and since then she's kind of gone on to do some different programs. She's written a lot of books. I believe one of them won a conservative award as well. But she's just a general conservative commentator, I'd say.
In your story, you touched on some responses she gave. Can you talk a little bit about the beliefs she expressed?
Yeah, so she really argued that DEI in its current form is harmful to colleges and that the programs they have and admit students into actually ends up hurting universities in the long run by, quote, catapulting into an academic environment for which they cannot competitively qualify through such DEI initiatives. And in essence, her argument really boiled down to the fact that black students on average score about one standard deviation lower on the SAT than the average American population, and how because of that, they shouldn't be allowed to go to rigorous or more like higher-end universities.
What impacts did MacDonald say DEI had on college campuses?
One of the major points she brought up was that black students have a lower graduation rate than a lot of their white counterparts, especially in the STEM fields. And the truth of that argument is there is really no evidence, I would say. If you look at a lot of the data that colleges publish, schools that have DEI programs actually have a higher level of black graduation rates than schools with no DEI, and they also have a lower black-to-white graduation gap than schools with no DEI.
What is the achievement gap, and what did MacDonald say about it?
So the achievement gap is this thing that has been researched and has been known about for a long time, basically since the civil rights movement started. And the whole ethos behind it is that basically, black and white students, on average, start at about the same level in, you know, preschool, kindergarten, grade one, grade two. And as they move up through the grades, we tend to see a larger and larger gap forming between the level of education of white students and their black counterparts. And so she's really talking about that. And for her, the argument really coalesced around how it can be seen in these lower SAT scores.
Asked about what would close the education skill gap, what response did she give?
A lot of the research on the skills gap has shown that there are lots of factors like your social economic status or the funding of schools around you or even your community, parents, anything like that are huge factors in contributing to the skills gap. She didn't really give any reason as to how to close the achievement gap. Instead, she argued that, quote, there should be more early emphasis on excellence in schools and not making excuses. I think we should all emulate Asian parents in their attention to students' school performance, doing homework, taking textbooks home, not running the streets. I think there needs to be a culture that values academic achievement. And so in saying this, she's kind of completely sidestepped the issue because I also interviewed her later and asked, you know, do you think there's any kind of economic factor that could be at play? And she basically just flatly denied the claim.
Ultimately, how do you feel frames like those shared by MacDonald will affect DEI initiatives at Wisconsin?
Yeah. You know, I think that such reductionist and frankly ignorant views really only work to harm students and the programs that support them. And honestly, I'm worried about the anti-DEI rhetoric that's really spawned in the last few years. And I think if UW continues to host speakers who stand opposed to university systems, well, I think we shouldn't be surprised if they one day get dismantled.
Was there anything else you wanted to include for this story but decided to keep out of the final cut?
Yeah, actually there was. There's a great New York Times article released about 1 year ago called America's Under Attack Inside the Anti-DEI Crusade. And in this article, they actually records requested some of Heather MacDonald's emails. She had a lot of statements to do with gay people and black officials and also immigrants. For instance, I think the most jarring quote from that article is when she called nannies who were taking care of other people's children, quote, low IQ third world immigrants. And if I've been able to include a bit more of that in the article and really show that this anti-DEI argument doesn't come from a place of caring about students or colleges, but comes from a place of hatred, I think that would have really made a good point.
Jake, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
In campus news, new UWPD chief outlines leadership vision, department's collaboration efforts. Brent Plisch, who has served as the University of Wisconsin-Madison's interim chief of police since February 2024, officially became UWPD's new chief on March 13th. According to the 2024 annual UWPD report, push introduced more comprehensive mental health resources and support for UWPD families. One of Plish's top priorities during his time as chief is to facilitate trust and respect in the Madison community and build relationships with those UWPD serves. And in other campus news, student government elections see highest voter turnout in years. 6% of university students cast their ballots, more than double the number of students compared to last year. ASM Chair Dominic Zappia said the higher turnout was due to, quote, increased energy from candidates and the presence of relevant referenda focused on student issues, unquote. And in other campus news, college Democrats and Republicans campaigned for the upcoming Wisconsin Supreme Court race. With the April 1st election weeks away, both organizations told the Daily Cardinal their campaigning tactics have largely stayed the same from the November presidential election. In support of Susan Crawford, the main issue college Democrats are highlighting for students is abortion rights. Joey Wendland, president of the college Democrats, told the Cardinal that, quote, reproductive freedom is always a big issue for students, unquote, adding other important campaign points include workers' rights and fair voting maps. In support of Brad Schimmel, college Republicans are highlighting safety. College Republicans co-president Ben Rothavy told the Daily Cardinal, quote, we're really emphasizing that it is a matter of public safety that we support Brad Schimmel, unquote.
That's all for the Cardinal Call this week. We've been your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom. You can find more news and stories from UW-Madison's student journalists at dailycardinal.com.
It's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather expert Rob McClure.
Well, a beautiful day today, at least most of the day, with just some passing cirrus and middling cumulus wafting overhead to block the sun, generated in the still quite cool air up in the second mile above ground level after that cold front swept through here last Sunday evening. Surface temperatures climbed up to 54 today after holding in the 40s the past couple of days, so that made for some steep low-level lapse rates, but generally modest cloud depths up above us given warmer temperatures further aloft up the air column and relatively dry air below. We are going to continue to warm into the coming days and probably a little more than I anticipated when I gave the forecast back on Monday morning, at least given the current look of the forecast models and especially some of the shorter range high resolution models which have become available since Monday with their portrayals both of tomorrow and Friday. I will note that the models remain at loggerheads on some fairly significant details with the storm that's going to be passing this coming weekend and producing this warming we'll see the couple coming days on its lead side. So nothing is set in stone yet, but the trend over the past couple of days has been to swing the incoming warm front with this storm fully north of us on Friday, at least by a county or two, if not more. And if we can thin the cloud cover then after that, or even clear the skies through a portion of the day, that may help us hit 70 or better, although I'd say the upper 60s are probably a better bet. I have a look at the water vapor image of North America that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll be able to see at the beginning of the image loop back on Sunday and Monday, an upper trough deepening over the Great Lakes region as the cold air that was pouring south southeastward behind Sunday's storm lowers the atmospheric heights overhead. And after that, an upper ridge begins building eastward off the Pacific Ocean, and that's what's warmed us modestly these past couple of days. And now behind that, a fairly deep swirl of low pressure is pressing towards the Oregon coast off the Pacific. And it's that feature, at least broadly speaking, which will be responsible for this weekend's weather, although unlike the past two or three big storms that have lifted through the area the past couple of weeks, the primary leftward spinning energy that you can see out there in the Pacific is going to remain swirling off the coast, actually into next week, although it is going to be accelerating a couple of smaller impulses underneath it or through it, which will spin up circulations over the center of the U.S. over the coming 5 days. The first of those, deepening over about Montana or the Dakotas on Friday, will be the feature which helps rotate the warm front, which will be shaping up to our southwest during the day tomorrow, northward past us, at least hopefully on Friday afternoon. That low will then be sliding southeastward with the upper-level wind, so it'll actually approach here as it translates southeastward on Friday evening. Even while a second low then begins to develop out over the Panhandle region or adjacent parts of eastern Colorado. Although there starts to be some greater divergence between the model scenarios as we get past that and into Saturday, there's general agreement that the second surface low will hold on a more southward track and make only slow progress eastward from there, finally reaching a meridian aligning with Wisconsin by, say, a midday Sunday, with most of the models holding that surface circulation south of us somewhere in Illinois. So although we'll start out warm on Friday, once System 1 drops past us with its cold front, that'll be either late Friday or early Saturday, we'll be in a much colder environment than for System 2. Temperatures will still be warm enough for rain, but probably, much like last Sunday's case, a cold, wind-driven rain. Despite a comparatively dry European model outcome, once we get through this entire storm on Monday morning, low pressure holds further, closer to us to our south in both the Canadian and Global Forecast Systems models, so that makes for a much wetter outcome. The surface pressure low pressure circulation will pass probably through about central Illinois, according to those latter two models. So that should put us in an area of steady rain on Sunday under the elevated frontal surface to the northwest of the low. So we may see overall an inch or an inch and a half of rain come down over the coming 5 days. But the bulk of that does look to be concentrated, say, after Saturday or Saturday evening. But back to the nearer term, tonight, passing high and mid-level clouds will continue to thicken up over coming hours as warm air from the plains starts to push in up in the second and third mile above ground level, especially as we get on towards midnight or after. The lower levels, I think, should remain dry enough to absorb any precipitation that's generated. Otherwise, temperatures will drop to the low 40s on light southwesterly winds coming down to 5 miles per hour or less as we get past sunset. Tomorrow, passing mid-level clouds should slowly clear out southeastward from here, and afternoon sun should take temperatures up to the low to mid-50s on southerly winds at 4 to 8 miles per hour. Winds will back more southeasterly as we go overnight, holding temperatures in the low 40s with the aid of thickening cloud cover. Warm frontal showers may then encroach from the southwest as we near dawn on Friday, heading to the east and northeast across the area. I think those should clear out to our northeast by the midday hours after putting down, I'm guessing, maybe a tenth or two of precipitation. Dew points will rise noticeably as we go through Friday morning, up into the upper 50s, or at least the mid-50s, and temperatures, as I mentioned, may reach 70 or better, especially if we clear during the late morning or afternoon hours of Friday, with increasing southwesterly winds coming up to 12 to 17 miles per hour. Southwesterly winds will then keep us warm and possibly all the way into the early evening or possibly even Saturday morning, but at some point a backdoor cold front is going to push southward across the area, veering our winds northerly again and dropping temperatures quickly down into the low 50s. Cloud cover and northeasterly winds will then keep most of Saturday much cooler, with temperatures holding probably steady just in the lower mid-50s. With rains likely moving back in, at least in earnest, later in the day, we may see passing showers during the earlier part of the day. Then we'll stay windy and cold and off and on rainy through the rest of the ensuing 36 hours, at least roughly speaking, with temperatures dropping into the low 40s overnight into Sunday, then recovering little from there on the day Sunday. Northeasterly winds will be up at 10 to 18 miles per hour overnight and through Sunday, eventually veering more northerly as rains knock off as we get into Monday. At the station down here on Bedford Street currently, the temperature is 53 degrees. The dew point temperature is 19. Winds are out of the west, fairly light, 6 miles per hour. Mixed cloud layers over the station currently. Cirrus up at about 25,000 feet or more, and altocumulus as well up at about 9,000 feet. And the barometer is at 30.13 inches of mercury and falling slowly.
It's now 6:48 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We go now to March 1963, when Mayor Harry Reynolds and his challenger fought over urban renewal. The school board made some big changes, and city government became a bit more open. Stu Levitan has the details from 62 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s. All the years come by. They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, March 1965. When Albert McGinnis, chair of the Madison Redevelopment Authority, decided to run against conservative Mayor Henry Reynolds, he should have expected that urban renewal would become a big issue in the campaign. As an appointee of the previous liberal mayor, Ivan Nestegan, and chair of the MRA since its founding in 1958, how could it not? A week after McGinnis beats Reynolds by 731 votes in the March 5th primary, it does, as the mayor attacks the MRA over its handling of the Triangle Project, particularly the 1959 relocation report that stated there was an adequate and affordable replacement housing. Quote, "The report was so fantastically inaccurate that anyone who had done a fair job of research would know immediately that it did not reflect the Madison situation," Reynolds says. Although the data about housing availability and the schedule of demolition came from city staff, Reynolds holds McGinnis personally responsible. Quote, "A great deal of needless human suffering arose out of the hasty and ill-planned removal of people from the Triangle Project and reflects the bungling of my opponent," Reynolds asserts, adding, quote, "Due to the speed with which the authority went ahead, the problem grew worse." Council conservatives supporting Reynolds chime in, claiming McGinnis, quote, "juggled MRA finances improperly." Not true. And supported regulatory practices as MRA chair that he opposed in his own private land development practice. That was true. State Representative Norman Anderson, another charter citizen member appointed by Nestegan, responds at an MRA meeting 2 days later, quote, "I resent any implication that we have bungled the renewal program or caused a great deal of human suffering," he says, adding that Reynolds attacked McGinnis for, quote, "purely political reasons." Alder Harold Rohr, who was vital to Reynolds' 1961 election but is now backing McGinnis, blasts the mayor's comments as, quote, "uncalled for and irresponsible. If he's got something to say, he should come here and say it." The MRA considers Rohr's proposal to invite Reynolds to a meeting but concludes that, quote, "nothing would be served by having the mayor appear before the authority and read the statement he has already released to the press." And there's no good news for the MRA and McGinnis from the Madison Housing Authority, which refuses to participate in the MRA's pilot program leasing properties to then sublease to displaced Triangle residents at discounted rents. And it tells the MRA it's not even interested in undertaking a study for a low-income housing demonstration program. Maybe all this nasty politicking has soured the mayor on elections. He wants Madison to bring back the city manager position it had from 1947 to 1951, when Reynolds served on the 7-member city council. Big news for city schools. In the first major school redistricting in more than 20 years, the board in early March votes to close the 47-year-old Abraham Lincoln Elementary School at 720 East Gorham Street after this school year. The school has only about half its capacity of 425 pupils. Closing it will save about $38,000 in annual operating costs and about $15,000 in teacher salaries. The board agrees to turn the entire parcel, including 330 feet of Lake Mendota frontage, over to the city. Mayor Reynolds says it has, quote, "good possibilities as a permanent home for Madison's cultural groups," and the Parks Commission directs Parks Superintendent James G. Marshall to develop a plan for that purpose. The Madison Art Association quickly expresses a strong interest in the property. 2 days after voting to shutter that central city school, the board endorses the purchase of an 80-acre site on the northeast corner of Mineral Point and Gammon Roads for a new Far West Side High School. It will be needed by the fall of 1966, when West High is projected to be at capacity. The board plans to spend $9.3 million in construction from 1966 through the end of the decade. And a bipartisan celebration for the trade schools. On the 12th, Democratic Governor John Reynolds and Republican Mayor Henry Reynolds, no relation, headline the dinner banquet celebrating the 50th anniversary of Madison Vocational, Technical, and Adult Schools. Other Jubilee events include a student dance, a food show, and talks. Cityside, on the 14th, the City Council unanimously approves 6th Ward Alderman George Elder's proposal to adopt and strengthen the state's open meetings law as city policy. All regular and special city meetings will henceforth have to be held in publicly accessible places with proper notice and be open except for personnel items and a few other specified matters. And on the 16th, the Police and Fire Commission names Ralph A. McGraw, 48, chief of the Madison Fire Department. The 23-year veteran of the department takes over when Chief Edward Page retires on July 1st. On campus, the first week of March is a heady time for 19-year-old pianist Ben Sidran. On the 1st, the Racine sophomore is a featured performer at the Military Ball, tickling the ivories in Wisconsin, outfitted for the night as Playboy Lounge. On the 2nd, the Daily Cardinal publishes his latest record review, a rave of the new album Empathy from pianist Bill Evans. A few days later, the Ben Sidran Quintet inaugurates live Friday afternoon jazz in a packed Rathskeller. On March 4th, the UW faculty rejects a resolution that would ban university sports teams playing schools from states that, quote, impede or attempt to impede civil rights enforcement. The existing policy prohibiting competition against teams from institutions that practice discrimination remains in place. On March 7th, with more than 10,000 American soldiers in Vietnam, designated by the U.S. government as military advisors and not combat troops, the group Students for Peace and Disarmament sponsors a public forum entitled Vietnam, Our Undeclared War. About 100 American soldiers have died in country. And two legends of words and music perform at the Memorial Union Theater with differing degrees of success. On the 10th, Pulitzer Prize winner W.H. Auden gives a lackadaisical, almost lazy poetry reading for a near-capacity crowd. On the 26th and 27th, guitar master Andre Segovia awes audiences with two sold-out shows with his survey of guitar styles over the centuries, everything but early lute music. Segovia first performed on campus in 1933 in Great Hall, only 2 years after his New York City debut. And that's this week's Madison the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported, music- and poetry-loving WRT News team, I'm Stu Levitan.
That does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Our headline writer this evening was Jack Goodman. Dane Buell and Sutton Johnson were our reporters. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Oliver Gerhardt, Ted Hingstrom, and Stu Levitan. Katie Drigella is our on-air engineer on Wednesday. Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Amy Owen. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
WORT Madison.
WORT is excited to be in our 50th year, and to help celebrate, we are hosting the opening night of Madison's newest venue, the Atwood Music Hall. Join us on Friday, June 13th, for a great night honoring Clyde Stubblefield. The night features performances from Mama Dig Down's Brass Band, The Funky JBs, VO5, Rare Element, DJ Trevor Banks, and Kaboom Box. Andy Moore from the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz will host the evening celebrating 50 years of WORT and the grand opening of Madison's newest venue at 1925 Winnebago Street. Proceeds from the evening benefit WORT. Tickets are $25 in advance and available now at theatwoodmusichall.com. Be sure to shine up your dancing shoes and grab your tickets before they're gone.
Good evening, and welcome to Query, Madison's longest-running show dedicated to LGBTQ+ issues. I'm your host, Matvey Mozhaev. And before we get started, I want to let you know that this episode discusses adult topics. In case this is not something you can engage in now, please tune in to the radio at 8 p.m. after this show wraps up. Before we begin, I would like to make a quick event announcement for all of those residents.